sort of deja vu, or am I this feeling like I was supposed to be speaking? It made me nervous for a minute. So I'm glad that those are set aside. Well, we have the privilege. We've heard from Ralph in different settings. He's been chairing a lot of our meetings and opening up with devotions, but this is our opportunity to actually hear him share and teach us. And he has a paper which is called, I believe it's No One Comes Empty-Handed. So Ralph, come, and we'll have him share about 30 minutes, and then we'll open it up for questions, as has been our practice throughout the conference.
Sort of.
That's why I re-emphasized.
Thanks, Jane. It's good to come to share. During the conference, when you prepare a paper before the conference and you're giving a paper at the end of the conference, you have to be very well aware that a lot of things have been covered before as well. So if there's repetition, I'm sure it's good for us. I hope there's not disagreement. And this paper that I have actually emailed to all of you is based on a paper I wrote in a slightly different circumstance. So I've adapted it, and so it may be a little bit disjointed on occasions, but we'll see where we go. And my particular interest in this whole area of mission at the moment is unhealthy dependency. And it's very closely related, as we've found already, to vulnerable mission, although it's not the same thing. It's not the same thing, but they're closely related. When a BMS missioner arrived in Western Uganda for the first time, she was introduced to the pastor she was going to work with. And his very first words to her were these: "No visitor comes empty-handed, so what have you got for me?" Very first experience of local people in the area where she was going to minister, and she was dumbfounded. She really hadn't got hold of the culture, she hadn't got hold of much of what was going on, and it really hit her hard. But it wasn't very long before she realised that this attitude of seeing the white person, people don't see the skin, they see the dollar sign or the pound sign. It does happen. Tim was commenting on it this morning in this earlier session, and it's very common. And one of the biggest disadvantages we have in mission is the colour of our skin. But it's this attitude of unhealthy dependency. Have I got it working? Yeah, good, mate. This attitude of unhealthy dependency, which is my concern, and which is going to come into this paper. It's a very unfortunate result of a lot of mission work that has been done in the past. It's very easy for us to criticise past people and past missionaries. We've got to be careful not to, because they lived within their lights and they've done tremendous work, even though now sometimes we feel that we're having to pick up the pieces. My mission experience has been largely in East Africa, although I was born in South America. My mission experience is in Eastern Africa. And if you want to know more about what that is, I can explain that later over coffee or something, but not particularly relevant at this moment. Biblical pictures of the church as the body of Christ, or as a family, make it clear that God's purpose for the parts of the church, his church, is not independent, isolated units, but dependent groups working together, with each part using its strengths for the benefit of the whole. If we see this on an international global level, as we do now, we can see some of the weaknesses of that very excellent model that has been used throughout the church mission life of the last century and a half, the three selves principle, which was produced by Henry Venn and Rufus Anderson. It depends if you're in England, you say it was started by Rufus Henry Venn. If you're in America, you say it's there. But they, at the same time, and in fact, there was somebody in the Philippines who actually had a similar idea as well. But the idea is that what are we aiming at in mission? What are we aiming at in planting churches? We're aiming at churches which are self-governing, self-supporting, and self-propagating. But we're not just looking at these individual churches on their own. We need to see them all interlinking, interdependent, working together as the body of Christ instead of lots of little bodies of Christ, supporting one another. Churches in the materially developed world, and I use that phrase instead of the West because I like to include the Australians as part of our errors. Well, that's great. Westerners from the South and the East, eh? Anyway, churches in the materially developed world have resources which can help the church in Africa grow. To unnecessarily hold these back could be to deny the fellowship of the interdependent worldwide church. On the other hand, to employ these resources ostensibly to help the developing churches, but acting in such a way that it hurts or stultifies their growth, is also to negate that fellowship. To use these resources in such a way that churches grow in depth and breadth and in fellowship with other churches is actually a sign of healthy dependency. To use these resources carelessly so that real growth is not encouraged or aided leads to unhealthy dependency. And it's this unhealthy dependency that's the subject of our thinking just now, seeking to consider some of its scope, not only in finance, but in other spheres of influence, and to see how this relates to vulnerable mission as currently enunciated by AVM. So what are we looking at in this sort of the scope of unhealthy dependency? Well, obviously, we've got finance as a major issue, and we've thrown that about, and we will throw that about, and it's been written about all sorts of times. But we've also got personnel and leadership. The use of people leads to dependency in amazing ways. Theology so dependent on us. The African Bible Commentary at the back here is a tremendous book. I don't know how many of you have used it or read it. You can gain a lot of insights from it. But somebody, one of the contributors said to me, once it's been through 5 or 6 adaptations, it'll be most useful. And some of it, you read it through, and it could have been written in Richmond, Virginia, even though it's written by Nigerians or Ghanaians or Kenyans. Some of it. We have to be careful. It's not all of it, some of it. So theology, we'll talk about that in a bit more detail. And then worship. Worship is an area where we actually, people can be dependent on the West or on the materially developed world. Sorry?
I'm Sydney.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And there are all sorts of areas of the basic infrastructure of the church where people in Africa, and I'm sure in other places too, are dependent or can become dependent on the church in the materially developed world. So let's start and look at some of these in a little bit more detail. The most obvious area for dependency, healthy or unhealthy, is finance. Christians and churches in the West have so much more materially than those in Africa. It's clear that true fellowship should involve sharing some of these resources. It's clear from the secular world that just giving money to African countries, or other countries for that matter, does not solve their problems, but exacerbates them and creates a lot more problems. And one of the times I got most upset with Tony Blair when he started talking about we will solve the problem of Africa by throwing money at it. The human nature that is at work in the secular world is not absent from the church and has historically been shown to be just as active and destructive. Seeking to just give money to solve the problems of the church in Africa, particularly in the area of poverty, has shown up greed, jealousy, dishonesty, and corruption, as well as stifling local initiative, local stewardship and local leadership, and also creating tension, massive tension, between parts of the church worldwide. That's among the recipients. Amongst the donors, there are equal evils that come up. There's the evil of pride, the evil of superiority, of self-sufficiency, the misuse of power, and playing God, as it's often been called. These are problems for the donors, equally as important to be faced and to be looked at. The sharing of financial and other resources is clearly an important part of Christian fellowship across the world, but it must be done judicially and carefully to avoid some of these traps. One of the pillars of AVM is, of course, to do cross-cultural mission using only local resources. And much has been said and written about this side of things, and it will continue to be, but my purpose in this paper is to look elsewhere, to look at some of the other issues that we're concerned with. Finance will always be raising its head in all of these other areas. It does. It has that habit. But let's try and think about some of these other areas. Sorry, I wasn't watching my PowerPoint. So, personnel and leadership. The gospel came to Africa through the people from the materially developed world, bringing their superior spiritual truths. Many, both from Africa and from the materially developed world, have associated all that comes from the MDW as superior. This includes personnel. The result of this is a lack of willingness on both sides of the situation for leadership to go into the hands of Africans, even when they're fully qualified to take it. This has led to the feeling of the white man is always right. In some cases it may be true, but in some cases it's probably because to disagree with the white man would be actually to lose the source of your resources, and that will also affect things. Add to this the fact that most folk who become mission overseas personnel have at some time or other felt they've had a personal call from God to do a particular task. And who can gainsay that? We can't gainsay it for somebody else. But sometimes God's call changes with circumstances, and mission personnel are not always the best to identify that and just hear God's call. I was speaking to the leader of one of the biggest missions in UK recently, and I'm asking him about this dependency issue, and he said something very interesting. He said, yep, he said, in our mission we've got two camps. We've got the one camp who just don't see dependency. They see they've been called by God to go and do this, and they're just going ahead and doing it in the way that they want to. They always have done. And yes, it is very often the older group who are in that group. But we have got within our mission many who do see dependency and who want to work in such a way to see the church growing itself and to develop itself. And that was this year I spoke to him. And it's relevant even today. In the paper which formed the basis for this paper, I identified at least five attitudes which give rise to this unhealthy dependency in personnel. One, when there is the mindset, either amongst Africans or people from the... I've got this up here, so I have. First, there is the mindset, either amongst Africans or people from the MDW, which feels that everyone from the West is superior to others. Secondly, when foreigners and all local people do not believe that local people are capable of effective leadership. Then the third one, when foreigners fail to train up local leaders. And then when foreigners insist on control and leadership, even when local qualified personnel are available. And finally, when structures are put in place that rely on foreign expertise and not local methodology. All of these we could unpack, and we could give I think many of us could give examples in each of these areas. I've seen each of these situations functioning. It's the often unintentional attitude of superiority from folk from the MDW, which is foundational for the other attitudes. Before we criticise others for this approach, it's important for us to seriously search our own hearts for past errors in this line, as well as our current beliefs. We say, how can someone involved in mission work who reaches out in love in Christ's name have this kind of approach? Unfortunately, we can. And unfortunately, we often do. It's of this attitude of bringing the love of Jesus to others that makes us feel we're giving the best gift in the world to others, and that everything we bring by association is also best. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, there were many missionaries included who genuinely did feel, and it was a genuine belief, that Africans were not up to the level of Europeans. It was a well-held belief. There was what I'd call a maverick missionary in Malawi, and if you wanted to look at some interesting missionaries, then this fellow is a very interesting man. His name was Joseph Booth. He actually set up 7 different denominations in Malawi. He had a lot of various very interesting ideas. But in a tract that he addressed to Queen Victoria, which says something about him, and the purpose of the tract was to deal with the problem of slaves and the settling in Africa. But his comment was about the missionaries around him. He said, even missionaries, many of them need teaching that the African is inferior in opportunity only. The African is inferior in opportunity only, not in any ways. And he actually put that into practice under a lot of opposition from other missionaries around him in Nyasaland, as it was at that time. He set up industrial missions with Africans in charge of them and Africans running them. And he got in a lot of stick from other missionaries. But one of those industrial missions, well, many of those industrial missions which he set up at the end of the 19th century are still functioning. And in fact, one of them spawned, as we might say, one of the first real challenges to white authority in Nyasaland, who's still considered the father of modern Malawi. And that was just nearly 100 years ago. Now, today there are probably very few people in mission circles, I'm sure none of us here, who would bring out the mantra of African inferiority. But by insisting people from the materially developed world have to be in certain positions in partnerships with churches and in the work in the third world, we do very often display that fact, that question of trust and lack of trust. Many aspects of this that could be discussed, and I think every one of us could bring out some anecdotal evidence about how we've seen that happening. It's a tricky subject. We've all probably looked in from the outside to other people's situations, and even our own, and felt that foreigners are too much in control of local church work, or too much in charge of decision-making or resources. They've been in the post too long. In many cases, we may be right, but it's not easy to suggest to some of these folk that the call they've had from God in the past may well have changed in the present. And I think for all of us in Christian work, especially those of us involved in mission, we should always be looking at the call God has given us and saying, does this call still hold now? And I can think of at least 3 occasions in my history in mission where I've had to stop and say, this is the call I had to the particular post I'm in now. What were the features of that call? How many of those still hold? And what is God saying to me to go into the next stage, into the future? And I think that's something we all of us need to do from time to time. Of course, one aspect of this which is relevant to VM is the assumed superiority of the English, French, or Spanish languages. Because these languages have been analysed and studied in such great depth and developed by linguistic experts, we feel that our languages are broader and superior. And now that the internet and modern communications have pushed English or American in such a way, we feel that everyone should learn it. Mission work is easier in it. Vulnerable Mission counters this approach as it points out how local languages speak from and to the local heart and express ideas which are essential to local culture in a way that foreign languages cannot. It's only when the good news of Jesus speaks right into the heart and culture that it can be said to have arrived. Most things outside this are really often just superficial and ineffective in changing people's lives. What's the way ahead? A large part of this in this area is education. And I'm not talking about education of people in Africa. I'm talking about education of the church in our country. Education to see what the real issues are. Education against the dangers of negative paternalism. The importance of understanding the local culture. Somehow, we've got to get into the local churches to get the message through about our relationship and the importance of letting people do their own thing in mission. One of the reasons for this is that so much cross-cultural intercourse nowadays is done outside the traditional mission agencies. John was talking about this yesterday, about when the agents are being hopped over. And well-meaning Christians and churches are linking across the continents in seeking to serve God without this background. Praiseworthy though some of these and many of these activities may seem to be, the results can be catastrophic as churches are planted which are unsustainable and thus become unhealthily dependent and, dare we say, without the in-depth work of the hearts of those involved. Let's move on because I'm sure I should be in trouble in a minute. But theology. One of the reasons why some workers from the West stay longer in a country than might be helpful is their fear of syncretism, mixing of the true faith with tribal ideas, and thus a false theology developing. I can think of one very good example of this, but I won't diverge just now. This seems to be particularly true in Bible colleges. On the surface, it seems a fair approach. Those of us from the materially developed world have had a longer experience of the Christian faith than local folk, had the advantage of study both in college and through books and so on. But there are so many weaknesses in this approach. Just look at one or two of them now. Much has been written in the past about differing worldviews between the materially developed world and Africa, and I'm getting the picture from Cambodia and from many parts of Asia too. We're not going to go into the definition of worldview. There are books and books and books written by it, and some I can understand, some I haven't got the faintest idea what they're talking about. Suffice it to say this, that in most cases, people from the materially developed world have a dualistic worldview, which seeks to separate out material and spiritual realities, and they're quite content to work in one or other of these areas without reference to the other. Most traditional Africans, and I'm putting in most and traditional because that's, I think, significant, have a more monistic worldview in which there is no separation of physical and spiritual. For them, each physical material experience has a spiritual meaning or experience underlying it. This is frequently more important to them than the dualists would call the physical side. Clearly, this will have an important impact on the way theology is understood. Moving from a dualistic approach to a monistic approach is not easy and may never be achievable. Part of the problem is that when folk from the materially developed world do not understand these differences and seek to apply theological approaches which are dualistic, thinking that is the best, This is an extension of West is best and can lead to an undermining of local understandings of important issues and further feelings of local inferiority to the materially developed world. Being brought up in the materially developed world, many missionaries have had no experience of some issues, do not know how to relate them to Scripture, and often in their ignorance, they either treat them as insignificant, or worse still, they treat them as of the devil, and thus to be put down at every opportunity. Early missionaries who took this approach could almost be excused. The general ignorance of things in those days. In the 21st century, there is no excuse. We've got the information. We can find this out. Issues which might come into this area. Are ancestral spirits, polygamy, family loyalty, and community ideas. There's just four of them. But these four, I think, are fairly important and fairly basic in the African worldview. Folk from the materially developed world have often condemned local attitudes in these areas and others far too quickly, without realizing how deeply these issues are part of local culture and tradition and inbred in many of these people. How much their attitudes to these things have been shaped, how much their attitudes to these things have been shaped by Western culture and tradition, rather than biblically. We'll just throw in a wobbly on this one. And how many times is the word marriage used in the Bible? Not very often. Just think about it. Failure to show a biblical attitude to these things and other African experiences, both in evangelism and in biblical teaching and training, does not reach the soul of many Africans and leads to a superficial theology. Jean has mentioned this a couple of times as she's been talking to us, but I do remember once driving 200 miles from Blantyre up to Lilongwe in Malawi, and a church worker, a lady church worker, asking for a lift because she needed to go up to Lilongwe to see the Minister of Education about her son's education. No problem, I said. I'll give you a lift. And we're travelling up, and we got to a particular point. She said, could we just stop here for a minute? I had somebody else with me, and I'll explain that in a minute. And she said, I've just got to go and get something. Can you wait for about 20 minutes? I said, yeah, fine. What's 20 minutes in 200 miles? And so we waited. Two of us in the car. And we then saw that she kind of went out into the field. And she was looking for something in the field. And I said to the person who was with me, I said, what's she looking for? What's she doing? She's looking for a particular root. So when she has that root in her pocket, when she's dealing with the people in the Ministry of Education, it will affect things for her benefit. This was a church worker. The theology that she had been taught had not got down to the real roots. So, sorry? Literally, yeah. Well, it shows you're awake anyway. Nobody's too far asleep, doesn't it? Those of us from our part of the world need to be prepared to take more of a back seat today in theological debates and listen to how the Holy Spirit is working in and through people from other cultures. We may well have a lot to learn about and new things to take back to our own countries. I had the privilege in Nairobi about 3-4 years ago of sitting in on a consultation, a theological consultation of leaders from African independent churches from all over Africa, and just sitting and listening to what they were saying. You know, some of us say those churches are way off beam. Some of them are much more mainstream than some of our Western churches are today. A real privilege to sit in and listen and see how they tackled these things. And I do commend things like the African Bible Commentary, because it's not perfect, but it does give you some guides. And most of you don't speak Luo, and so you do need to have it in English. The significance of this for EM, for Vulnerable Mission, is shown by research done by Dr. David Barrett in the 1960s. In his book Schism and Renewal in Africa, Barrett claimed that the explosion of independent African churches, which occurred about that time in Africa, was at least in part related to the translation of parts of the Bible into many African languages. It was as though Africans were reading the Bible for the first time for themselves and listening directly to what God was saying to them from his word, rather than listening to what the missionaries felt they ought to know. This encouraged them to contextualize their faith. It encouraged them to start tackling the issues of fatalism, of ancestral spirits, of polygamy, and all these other African issues which come up, without having to go through the Western missionaries and coming up with their own ideas. This is clear justification for using local languages wherever possible. Giving people the Bible in their own language and sitting back and listening to the way God speaks to them through his word, rather than telling them what it means, has not been a characteristic of a lot of modern missions. We tend to want to tell people, not just give them God's word and hear what God says through them. I must move on. Jean will be after me. Sorry? Oh, whoops. Okay. Let's worship. It's been my privilege to worship in lots of very rural African churches. I want to just tell you two of them. One was in Malawi, where it was in the north of Malawi, where the Presbyterians had done a lot of mission work. And we sat in this a very, very rural situation in this church, and I tell you, they sung Scottish metrical psalms even slower than they do in England. Yeah, well, that may well be. And then another church I went to in Tanzania, this was a very interesting situation. In Tanzania, they have a hymn book of hymns which is used by nearly every denomination, called Tenzi Zarahoni. Yarahoni. And in that hymn book, 99% of the hymns, and maybe slightly more in percentage, are in Swahili. Great, you say. But let me tell you that 98% of those hymns owe their origin to Golden Bells, Sankey's Songs and Solos, and one or two other American books. There are only three, I think, in the whole book that are of Tanzanian origin. And those books are used every Sunday, right through the Anglican Church, right through the Baptist Church, right through many churches, those books are used. You go out in the bush, and you're going to, I remember this, this is where my son-in-law took me on one occasion. And you're sitting there, and you are there, you've brought the reverend priest with you, because he doesn't normally get there, he gets a lift from you. His wife is there, my daughter and son-in-law, my wife, me were there, really boosted the congregation. And then there were lots of other folk. Sorry. Lots of other folk in the service. And we sung hymns from the book. And who was singing? The priest, his wife, my wife. Just the five of us, really. The others were completely at a loss. But in both of those services, in the Presbyterian service in Malawi and in this service in Tanzania, as soon as a choir sang, the atmosphere changed kabisa. It changed completely. There was life. They knew what they were singing. There was dancing. It was them worshipping, because they were worshipping in their own, not just language, because they've been worshipping in their own language before, but they were worshipping using their own hymns. And I think there's a lot for us to think about in that aspect that we have imported. I know of a missionary family in Burundi, Rwanda, Burundi, they kind of spread across. And the great grandfather was the one who actually translated the Bible first into both Kirundi and Kinyarwanda. And it said that he translated the whole of the hymn book. You see, that's great for his time. But what about now? And actually using this. So I can see Jean's moving me on. So all right. Just very. How do you break him off? That's right. So how do you shut that fellow up? Eh? But very quickly, not just in the writing of hymns and the singing, but the instruments. This is a big thing, isn't it? For many of us who've seen it. When I was working with APF, what did people do? They used to send in letters. Please, will you send us? And what's the first thing they asked for? PA system, keyboard, amplifier. What are those things? That's linked in with Vulnerable Mission. The cost of those instruments. They can only get them if you pay for them. And they can only be repaired if you pay for it. And they can only use them if you pay for the electricity. There's a lot to be thought through. And you can have another look. You can look in the paper when you come through that. And then just, if I can, very quickly, basic infrastructure of the churches. Many ways in which the missionaries in the past have not only brought the gospel and their own take on theology to Africa, they've also brought their own culturally related structures. These have included an emphasis on buildings, on theological training, and on things like orphanages and hierarchies, just the four areas where you might think about. And there are lots of others. I've thought of many others, but these are some we can think about. Buildings. Why do we always look after buildings? I don't know those who were awake when I did that Serampore lecture, quoting from Carey in those early days. You know, kind of saying, why is it that the Indians can do the work better than the Brits? They don't look for buildings. They'll preach under the trees. They have other ways of doing the things which we do. And we have buildings cost so much money, both to build, just to put up, and to maintain. And do we need the same emphasis on buildings? That comes in true with theological training. We, as missionaries, those of us go from the West, we actually have had training in a theological college. Well, I didn't before I went, but most have. We've had study, we've had all sorts of college-centered training. Do they need that in Africa? That's right, absolutely. I won't point that one too many directions. But there's a lovely group of Anglicans down in southeast of Congo, a place called Lubumbashi. A couple of Anglican priests there who've realised the problems with having all their training centred in the college right in Lubumbashi. And they've gone out. They've gone out and they have held training courses in the villages. Who's paid for them? Well, they haven't had to pay for food because the villagers have paid for their food. They haven't had that publicity because people have wanted to come in for the training. They have only had travel expenses of getting A to B and then looking after their family while they're out in the villages. A tremendous model for theological training. There's a lot of other models which don't necessarily centre on a building and on staff who are well educated and therefore have been to European colleges and therefore are bringing in the West in that way. Orphanages. I have a real dislike of orphanages. It doesn't fit. I mean, I'm generalising now, but in the African situation, orphanages don't fit. What is the purpose of an orphanage? Purpose of an orphanage is to look after children whose family have died and can't care for them. Fine, that's the purpose. How do the local people deal with that problem? They don't have buildings that they bring them all into and bring in expensive staff to care for them, and they're going to look after the buildings and all of these things. They don't take them out of their context and put them in with something which is foreign. They look after them in the community. If we want to help those orphans, brilliant idea. Let's help them by helping the community and those in the community who are looking after the orphans. But you see what happens? We love orphanages in the West. We can get lovely pictures of children who are in need. We can get all of these things, and we don't hear of the children who've been taken out of their family background, taken out of their culture, to live in an artificial situation, who, when they leave the orphanage, have no identity, can't fit into life, and have real problems with it. But we love to give to orphanages. Donor-powered infrastructures. We've got to beware of those. And hierarchies, I'd love to hear from people. This very, very quickly, Jean, honest. I'd love to hear from people who work in different parts of Africa, because I heard the story the other day that it depends which tribe in Kenya, and I haven't cleared this with Jim, so I'm not sure whether he agrees with this, but in different tribes in Kenya, either the chief is the big man or the witch doctor is the big man. And if you fit into the hierarchy of that tribe, you will find all sorts of interesting things. We've actually brought in our hierarchies within the church. We've brought in our denominational structures. We've brought in our way of doing things without looking around and seeing how is the community developed? How does the community deal with these things? And that's what we need to do. Just quickly, if the chief is the boss, then he's expected to provide things for you. If the witch doctor is the boss, you go to him with gifts in order to appease him and appease the spirits. That affects the church in its attitudes to stewardship and giving. I'll leave you to think about how, but it does. I've overshot time, but my purpose was to actually help us to see that we've got a much wider area of church life than just finances, in which we are causing unhealthy dependency, and we've got to think these things through in all sorts of ways. But I've only taken an hour of the half an hour. Jean. Questions? Jim.
I have the impression
I had a very interesting argument about that with my son-in-law in Tanzania, where they use this Tanzania Rahoni. And the answer is, I don't know at what point. But what I do know is that very often those hymns, they don't necessarily express the heartfelt worship of the people, their language. Yeah. And I think that there may be times, and I'm not going to kind of say it, there may be times when that is the case, when people have grown up second and third generation Christians, as it were, in a particular environment, that is what they are worshipping. They have learnt to worship in those ways. But I think it is still a Western modification, and we need to do much more about the local. Jim? Sorry, I'm not Peter. Not necessarily. Some TE books are available in local languages.
So I'm just saying, in the lazy context, they have a choice of English, or the
There's one phrase that you used in that which I can't agree with. When you say, it's easy, you just have to. TEE, in its purest form, is absolutely brilliant, especially when it is using books which have been translated into the local language or written by local people, as does happen in some parts of Africa. However, human nature gets involved in a lot of these situations. And in I think, John, did you know anything about TE in Uganda, John? Yeah. TE in Uganda has had an exceptionally checkered career because of the individuals who were involved in it. That's why I say it's a personal thing. And the hierarchy sometimes don't like it because they can't control it so well. And in Uganda at one stage it was working very well within the Anglican Communion, and then the person who was running it got stuck in an office and he couldn't get out and train people to run it properly, and it all actually came to a little bit of a not quite a complete close, but the program ran down quite a bit. I think it's picking up again now. I've seen it in Malawi, I've seen it in lots of places. It is brilliant. Some of my friends have written the book, so what? yes, Fred.
Thank you.
I think that phrase is excellent. I mean, we use that in our own circumstances. It took us a lot longer to do it than we expected. But if you set out on your mission partnership to do yourself out of a job, if you've got in mind that I'm looking and working towards that time when I'm unnecessary, then it affects the way you do things rather than the settling in and saying, here I am, and this is where I'm going to be. God's called me here and I'm going to stay here. Yeah, and I think it's... Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So basically, before you said, I work myself out of the job, I said, well, who should be doing this job? Should this job be done? Is this a real job for an African?
Yeah. And, I think, whilst I would want to agree with you, John, in basic principles, I look at the history of mission, at the little bit that I've seen and I've read about her over the years, and I do see God has taken people who haven't got that background and haven't got that training and has used them in a mighty way. When we look at it through God's eyes, sometimes he does that. When we look at it through our eyes and our planning, which is where we have to start, because let God come and speak to us in it, then we have to say that. I could have gone on another tangent, but Jean's standing there. So.